5th edition of Dead Pit Radio. I am the only one in the Dead Pit studio right now. I don't know how much info Uncle Bill wants out there, but as far as a complete episode of Dead Pit this week, you know, with me, Uncle Bill, and Jesco, that's not going to happen and probably won't happen for a while. I just don't know what, you know, what's going on entirely. I know that they are both in Lexington right now, and the latest I've heard is that they're going to try to deliver that baby sooner than later. So if I get any updates and he wants me to update anybody online, I will let you guys know. Everything is fine from what I've been told. I'm texting back and forth with Uncle Bill. I don't want to be too annoying, you know. I know this is real life stuff, and you know, this show was definitely secondary to all this stuff. But since we did say that this Heather Langenkamp show was going to be on August the 5th, I went ahead and thought, you know, well, I want to put that fucking interview up. That interview is like a 45-minute interview, and I want to put that up in the next segment. And, you know, that'll be the show for this week. And I'm going to attempt, and I don't know, you know, I don't know how successful I'll be, because it's always more fun to have a few people in here, and it's always good to play and joke around and stuff like that. And the show isn't as fun, you know, just doing this shit by myself. So I don't know what will happen with the show over the next few weeks. I will tell you that my idea is, hopefully for next week, is to just take a bunch of phone calls. It's been about a month since we did the phone calls. So, and from what I've been told, the situation with Uncle Bill and Jesco, that's going to be something that's going to be a few weeks. And, you know, we're just going to continue on here, whatever way we can, you know, to do a horror talk radio show for you guys. But yeah, I mean, I don't really, I don't know what else to say. It's kind of a bittersweet show, because after 5+ years of us trying to get Heather Langenkamp on the show, we did do that interview a couple of weeks ago, almost 3 weeks ago now, actually. And the plan was to hype it up for this, you know, this first week in August episode. And we got the interview. We did record the interview. Like I said, it's been about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And, yeah, I mean, now this is the big show, and Uncle Bill and Jess, of course, are not here to talk about it. And they're going through, I'm guessing, a stressful situation. Just an honest assessment here. So, yeah, what I want to do, like I said, take a break from this this segment, and then we're going to go into our special interview that was recorded, like I said, 2 or 3 weeks ago with Heather Langenkamp, Nancy from the Nightmare on Elm Street series, and that will be the entire show this week. I know there'll be some people complain, whatever else. Look, this was a spur of the moment thing that came up yesterday. That's the day I'm recording this, and yeah, I mean, there's nothing. It's real life, folks. Real life gets in the way of hobbies a lot of the times, and it's happened with me, and it's happening with Uncle Bill and Jess right now. And I just wish, you know, I hope everything turns out okay, and I will try to keep you guys posted. I've been a little worried about this thing, to be honest. And people on the internet, let me be honest with you guys, are cruel about a few things and have been mean and hateful and stuff like that. And that's the internet for you folks. But, you know, Jess is really cool. I've never had a problem with anything, you know, associated with her. I think that she's funny and she's, You know, Uncle Bill is a lucky fella to have found Jesco, imported her from Michigan. And I just really hope everything works out, and I think it will. You know, he seemed to have high spirits and stuff like that, and yeah, just really hope for the best. And I'll keep everybody posted on the message board and stuff like that. I haven't really been posting much stuff on there in the last little bit, but I will try to keep everybody up to date on what's going on. And you know, this is but anyway, yeah, lighter subject for the horror fans out there, for fans of Nightmare on Elm Street. I want to take a break, and when we come back, we will have that interview with Heather Langenkamp
here on DeadPeer.com.
This is Eurocult, celebrating the films of Dario Argento, Lucio Fulci, Sergio Martini, and others. Come join us. Come join the cult. You can find the cult at Eurocult.mypodcast.com. We'll be waiting.
First question, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got started in the movie business.
Okay, I grew up in Tulsa. I went, you know, just to public school in Tulsa, and then went to like a private junior high school. And my dad got a job in Washington, D.C., working in the Carter administration. And so that kind of upended our family, and we all moved to D.C., where I went to a pretty fancy all-girls school there. And I fell in love with acting in at that high school and was a member of the drama club and all that, and learned a lot about acting there, actually. I had a really wonderful teacher named Patricia Witt, and I got one lead in the high school play, and that pretty much made me want to be an actor. And after I graduated from high school, my dad had moved our family back to Tulsa because Carter lost the election. So we all moved back to Tulsa, and that summer, Francis Ford Coppola was making two movies in Tulsa, and I went and auditioned for a part and got a small role and got my SAG card in Tulsa as a result of that. And so that started me on the path of, you know, getting a little farther along to be an actor. And then I went to Stanford, and when I had any free weekends or any free time, I would fly to L.A. and audition for roles. And that was kind of a fun time to be in Hollywood because the Brat Pack was really big, and you know, John Hughes was making all of his movies, and so there were just really great auditions all the time, and I would fly down, and then eventually I convinced my parents to let me actually live in L.A. for a few months, and at that time is, you know, I was going back and forth quite a bit, but I got Nightmare on Elm Street.
Now, you said that you had gone to Stanford. Was your major in film, or was there something else you were working on?
You know, I started out, I really wanted to work, like, in the government because I had just, you know, lived in Washington, D.C., and, you know, all my friends, we were really all very interested in the government and being in the Foreign Service or whatever, being, you know, working at a senator's office or things like that. And so I started out as a Russian studies major. I really, you know, the Russia was going through their turmoil at the time, and I really wanted to do that and work in Russia and learn Russian. So that was how I started college. But once I started going to Los Angeles a lot and really getting more and more jobs, then I decided to change my major, and I ended up being an English major.
Now, Nightmare on Elm Street, the audition process, I knew that I'd read that it was a long, like, there were a lot of auditions for Nancy and stuff like that. Can you describe what all went on?
Yeah, you know, I only remember going on two auditions for that part. The first audition, I think I just read for the casting director, Annette Benson, and then I came back. And the second audition, I remember Wes was there, and I read with Mandy. And it was not as bad as some, that's for sure, for me anyway. it was, you know, sometimes you have to just go through like 8 auditions, you know, to meet every single person. But because it was an independent film, there weren't that many layers of executives and all these, you know, people who have to see you. So actually, as auditions go, it wasn't bad at all.
Now, were you just coming off TV at that time? I mean, were you segueing like from TV to film? Did you have film experience before that, like leading roles?
No, not. I mean, my very first job had been a really, really, really low budget, super low budget independent film called Nickel Mountain. That was my very first job, really. I also had done some movies of the week, and then I had done some of those like after school specials and commercials. I had done like one of everything. By the time I got Nightmare, I think I had done a commercial and a movie of the week and one other independent film. So, I mean, I wasn't completely green. You know, Johnny Depp, it was his very first movie ever.
Yeah.
Ever first job. So I was a little more experienced than him, but not much.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because it was his first film, and he is actually from our area originally, I think.
Yeah, in Kentucky.
Yeah. And just wanted to know if you've stayed in contact with – I know you stay in contact with Amanda and I think Jesu Garcia. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But,
and Robert, of course. Yeah, you know – no, I don't know any of us have kept up with Johnny as we would have liked to. And no, yeah. That's a simple answer.
Well, okay, talking about the film a little bit, though, your thoughts initially about, like, the script and the idea behind the movie and things like that?
Well, you know, I didn't see a lot of horror movies, so I didn't know if it was good or bad, and, you know, I didn't really imagine that it was going to be as bloody and disgusting as it was. I mean, I read the description, but to me, you know, the way that they shot it was actually a lot more intense than the way it reads on a piece of paper. So I didn't really know what to imagine was going to happen. So I just watched really closely, and then when I saw it, you know, I thought, oh, my gosh, this, you know, who's going to see a movie this violent? Who's really going to ever want to see this R-rated movie for kids? I mean, you know, it was going to be R-rated for sure. And so I think, you know, Wes's other movies had even been rated X for their violence, level of violence, and then I kind of understood, like, what Wes was all about after I saw those scenes being shot. And then I thought to myself, well, you know, it'll be a small movie. I mean, nobody will see this movie because it's so disgusting and violent. And so I just kind of, like, put it off on the side, like, oh, well, let's just keep moving onward. Let's keep getting parts, and don't worry about this. It's not going to help my career at all because no one's going to see it because it's so disgusting and violent. So, and I was wrong.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
What was a typical day like on the set? Because I know, like, especially effect sequences and stuff, like the bathtub sequence and Tina's death scene, which is, everyone always talks about that one, too. I mean, like, how long was a day shooting that stuff?
They usually give every big effect scene one day, which is nothing. Because we were shooting on a soundstage, that set was being prepared for weeks, you know, until the day that it was ready for the actors, and then it was ready. And that rotating room we used several times, and so I don't know which one came first, Johnny's death scene or Amanda's scene. I have a feeling Amanda's scene was first. So you know, the set decorators decorated it, you know, and then on one day, they just strapped everybody in and did that scene. And it might have been a day and a half, but it wasn't, you know, weeks. And then for Johnny's scene, they, you know, redecorated it again. It probably took them a couple of weeks to repaint, redecorate it. And then they were ready for the Johnny scene. And, you know, I just remember walking in and just seeing all the blood, like, coming out of that window and seeing everybody going, oh, no, we spun the room the wrong way. Like, it was one of these days where they had worked so long to get the shot ready, and then when push came to shove, someone really screwed it up. And the blood was supposed to the room was supposed to revolve the opposite way, and the blood was supposed to drip down the ceiling. But the way that the guys hadn't thought about it, they revolved it the other way, and the blood went out the window. So there was no blood to drip. And we couldn't set it all up again. It was a one-shot deal. And so that was a good example of Wes just being really brilliant. And he said, oh, we'll just make it work in the editing. And so what they did is they created that huge wind effect, like, you know, the magic of Freddy had made the blood go away. And, you know, those things happen on the set all the time. And when you don't have a lot of money, you just have to make do, or you have to find the money. And you know, we didn't have any money at that point. We were all just trying to get it finished in time. And we already, I think, had to borrow money and, I don't know, make some kind of last-minute deal to get that movie finished, from what I understand.
I guess another of the biggest parts of that movie is the relationship between you and Krueger throughout the film. So what was, I mean, when you first met Robert Englund, what were your impressions about him and then the look of the character and that sort of thing?
Yeah, Robert really worked hard to make that character really scary in the first movie, and he had a lot of body movement and posture, the way he stepped out of the dark shadows and everything he did with the glove. I mean, he really, you know, he really worked it, and it's really difficult to do that when you don't have a lot of lines. I mean, he didn't have many lines at all. And so he was just this thing that kind of appeared in your dream and you know, lots of chasing and physical action, but he didn't have a lot of things to say. And I just feel like the reason that that character, Robert Englund, has made it so special is that, you know, he took something that really was kind of like Jaws, you know, it just doesn't appear that much, and when it does, it has to make a big impact.
Mm-hmm.
And only a really fine actor can really do that.
But I mean, in a certain way, like, he kind of needed that performance from you as well to, like, balance the film out, because you kind of, like, the relationship between you and he is kind of what makes that whole film. You have to get strong towards the end and set up all the traps and all that stuff. I mean, I don't think...
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, I always knew that Nancy had to be a big fighter. I mean, she had to be, like, life or death fighting all the time against Freddy, and she had to know that and know that that was the only way she could live, is if she really fought to, you know, to the death.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my attitude in presenting that character. And I always knew in my heart that she won the battle, because I always feel like she was the winner in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Wes wrote it that way. So when she walked out the door that morning and the sun is shining, in the original script that I read that I, you know, signed on to do, Nancy defeats Freddy, and there was no question about that. And then, of course, you know, as we were shooting the final scenes, the producer wanted to make it open-ended and make it not so definite and make it seem like Freddy... well, I mean, Wes actually had written the line where the car pulls up and the Freddy Cadillac kind of comes up and picks up Nancy and Glenn is driving. But it was so clever, because you didn't know whether she was just still in her dream.
Mm-hmm.
And she was still going to be battling another day. And that's, and then, you know, but Glenn is alive and Tina's alive. And so it's just this really mysterious ending. And so, you know, I kind of ended the movie thinking, well, she hasn't died yet. You know, Nancy's not dead. She's still living. And she's still inside of her dream, and she's still going to be battling Freddy. So that's, I've always thought that about Nancy, and I still do. I really feel like she fought him, you know, really nobly, and it didn't come to a conclusion in the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what do you think about the success of the movie? And I know that New Line, pretty much, they put everything on the line, hoping that this would be a success. And what were your thoughts seeing the finished film for the first time?
You know, I just never gave it, like, enough credit for being as good as it was when I was young like that. I mean, I really liked it, and I really was entertained by it, and I thought it was good. I mean, it's hard to think when you're young, you never like your performances that much. At least I never did, and so I just didn't feel like my friends were going to like it. It was that kind of thing. Like, I was like not sure that my agents were going to like it. You know, I liked it. And everyone that was in it, we were really proud of it. But we didn't know, like, if it was going to really do that well. And then when it came out, I remember I walked down to the store and bought a Variety, and it had that big double page over the fold, you know, ad that just had announced how well it did, and you know, people close to me were congratulating me. But, you know, Hollywood didn't really recognize it for at least 10 or 15 years.
Wow.
I mean, they didn't really recognize it as, like, this iconic thing, you know. Well, maybe, say, 6 years, and then, you know, no one ever talked about it as this incredible franchise, so at least, like, 10 years into it.
Now, I had read that you'd turned down the Elm Street 2, and you really kind of stayed away from the genre until Dream Warriors. Was that on purpose, or did you not want to get typecast in those type of films?
No, I wasn't offered Nightmare 2 at all. It was a totally different script and director and writer. They just stayed away from me. I did not stay away from them. I was hoping, you know, you're always hoping that a sequel gets made of your movie, but they did not want Nancy in that movie. And so it was Wes who wrote the script for Nightmare 3 that brought Nancy back.
Did you ever see the sequel, Nightmare on Elm Street 2?
You know what? I've just seen bits and parts of it. I haven't, like, sat down and watched the whole thing, but I've watched more and more of it because I've become better friends with Mark Patton. So I've seen a lot more of it than I had in the past.
I think, isn't he working on some, like, a similar type of, like, a documentary film or something like that about his experience?
I think so, maybe. I know I heard him say something like that at the last convention I was at.
Yeah, it would have been, was that the Texas?
No, we went to Indianapolis.
Oh,
right,
okay.
Near you. Yeah.
Okay. And they had the big Scream Queens panel that, yeah, everybody was a part of.
He seems like,
oh,
yeah.
It was really fun.
I haven't got to meet him at a show, but he seems like quite a character for sure. He's very...
I know he's really entertaining and really loves his role as Jesse now after many years of not really thinking about it. And now he's really just... He's been offered so many opportunities and he's doing all sorts of panels and things like that that really, when we did the documentary Never Sleep Again and we found him in Mexico, he operates a kind of like a micro lending organization down there and then also has a wonderful store where he sells these beautiful kind of indigenous art forms down there. Now he's really come back and, you know, he's such a wonderful actor. He's taking advantage of his new notoriety.
Now, as far as the Elm Street 3, the Dream Warriors, I guess Freddy at the time, he turned into more of a comedic character with the one-liners and stuff like that. Which Freddy did you prefer? Because I guess he went back in New Nightmare to be the serious Freddy again. Like comedy or serious for you? Which one do you think works better?
I don't know. I mean, I always like the drama. I like the scary Freddy more. I totally love the funny Freddy, but for me, you know, because I was always battling him, I found it much easier when he was the mean and scary Freddy.
Now, looking back at the cast, though, of Nightmare on Elm Street 3, that was a pretty amazing cast. I mean, you had Patricia Arquette, you had Lawrence Fishburne in a role. What was it like to work with some of those actors?
Oh, it was really great working with them. I mean, they're all really good actors, and it's always, all those kids were excellent actors, too. I mean, there wasn't really a bad apple in that whole bunch, but it was, you know, when everyone takes their part really seriously and no one is, you know, sometimes actors think that they're too good for the part that they've accepted in the movie or whatever. But none of the people have ever been like that in Nightmare on Elm Street. As far as I know, it's always been like, so everyone is trying really hard to make the best movie that they can.
Something I wanted to talk about for sure is because we've always talked about on our show how important Robert Englund is for the whole series. And that, in my opinion, has never been more clear if you've seen that remake. I don't know if I don't know what your thoughts are on it if you've checked it out.
No, I didn't check it out. I just, I didn't want to develop any bad attitudes about Jackie Earl Haley because of my feelings about Robert Englund playing that part. And so I just decided not to see it. And because I know that he did a really good job, and I know that it was a tough role to step into after, you know, 20 years practically of Robert Englund playing that mm-hmm. part. And I don't think that I just don't know if I needed to see any of those images again in my mind. I like the ones I have from Nightmare One. Mm-hmm. But I do hear they're making another one. I can't believe it. So.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
Well, it just seemed like to me, I mean, more than just the Freddy character, that it was just quickly just thrown together, you know, and they didn't really... you can tell a lot of times, like when they make these remakes of movies, the classic movies, that they don't have the... You know, they don't have the spirit behind it, you know, that they really want to do good. It's just like a, seems like a cash in on the name more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like cooking, you know, if you're making your own recipe and it's going to be your own special barbecue sauce that you're going to give to your friends and you need it to be perfect so you spend, you know, all your time on it, it's going to be a different barbecue sauce than if somebody is just reading a recipe out of a book and just buying all those ingredients at the store and hoping that they can match it. It's just, it's a different process, and it's something that the movie industry needs to do to make money, maybe, and keep the profits rolling in, and reminding new generations of this great franchise, because there are people that, believe it or not, are only going to see that. So, you know, that's they're going to be introduced to Freddy only that way.
That's a depressing thought.
It's unfortunate, yeah.
I know, but anyway. You guys have to face facts.
I know.
There's little 13-year-olds who would just know that as Freddy. So what I like is that I do see kids who do see that movie first, then come back and want to see the original, and that's really awesome because then I think they get the best of both worlds.
That's true. Okay, so you got Nightmare on Elm Street 1, you're going into 3, and then... I mean, things seemed to go pretty well in 3, and then you came back with Craven for the new Nightmare. Of those films, which one do you think stands out to you?
Well, they all stand out for different reasons, but, I mean, I think, you know, gosh, I mean, I think Nightmare 7 is such a great movie. I mean, I've always really, really loved that movie because I like the story so much. It's so different, and Wes really, really went to a new level of originality in that movie, and the breaking the fourth wall and going between the two characters and where, you know, slicing and dicing reality like that and making Nancy and Heather be, you know, kind of one and the same. I just really think that movie has a lot to offer audiences want to think. And of course, Nightmare 1 will always be my favorite because it's just the classic original. And Nightmare 3, you know, working with those kids, and again, a really interesting script, and Wes wrote that script. Just taking that idea of Freddy in your dreams one more level so that he can be invading all the kids' dreams at the same time, it was really a pretty cool idea.
I just kind of thought that New Nightmare was a little bit ahead of its time. Like,
it was really modern. Yeah, it really was. And the horror industry wasn't really ready to embrace it. It wasn't bloody enough. It wasn't gory enough. Even though there were some gory scenes, I think that Wes probably wanted to see if he could make a horror movie that didn't have, like, something really disgusting. I think he wanted to attract people who might be turned off by that kind of violence. And I kind of respect him for it because now that I'm older, I don't enjoy watching like people get eviscerated on screen, but I really like horror, and so I appreciate it when someone tries to make people like me happy. And I think I'm there. There should be some blank DVDs. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, but I think that Wes is not appreciated enough for that script and how unusual it was, and putting all those real-life people in it was lots of fun.
Yeah, it really was something different at the time and sort of a precursor to Scream in a few ways, I thought, especially watching it back now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it definitely was a precursor, and Kevin Williamson, you know, I think gets a lot of credit for that script when really... it was extremely, you know, derivative of what Wes had already done.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you at all apprehensive about sort of playing yourself, and there was a character playing your real-life husband and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, I didn't really love it. I just, you know, God, you work so hard to maintain your privacy. I mean, it's really like the worst part of being an actor, and it really sucks. So I thought to myself, oh, you know, I have to make this devil's bargain. To get this part, I have to agree to be myself. And I just really, really, really just...
Because we've talked to many people on the show that, you know, females especially, that have had a lot of issues.
Yeah, you have a lot of, really serious fans who think it's funny to kind of make you feel unsafe in the world you live in. And it's the worst part of being an actor, like I said.
Well, let's transition to something a little bit brighter, though. You got contacted for Never Sleep Again. Was that?
Well, I wanted to make a documentary myself, actually, and I had talked to several people about helping me, and the only thing I didn't really have was I didn't have financing. And so we thought, you know, this is what we want to do. We want to have, you know, important people involved and get Robert Englund and Wes Craven, of course, involved, and Bob Shea. And I felt really confident I could get those people involved. And then I contacted Warner Brothers to see how I could manage to, you know, get the clips. And because the new reboot of Nightmare was coming out, they weren't giving out any clips at all. They weren't interested in having anybody license any material for documentary or anything. They were very, very protective of what they had. And so my associate, Tommy Hudson, he said, look, I've got a guy over here who also wants to do a Nightmare documentary, and he's willing to get the financing constructed and, you know, going. And he also really wants to do it fair use, where we wouldn't license the clips. We would just make a documentary that, you know, uses the clips and uses this doctrine that says when you're making a documentary, you can use very limited usage of copyright material as long as you're not abusing it and you're using it for information purposes, news purposes, or, you know, to illustrate something that someone has said in their interview. So we teamed up as a trio, Dan Farrens, Tommy Hudson, and myself, and then Andrew Cash came in as well. And we, you know, I tried to get the big players like Robert and Wes and Bob Shea to agree to be interviewed, which they all did, and I was really flattered that they trusted me enough to do that. And then the other guys worked on getting all the actors and writers, directors, producers of each show lined up. And that's how they found Mark Patton. They worked really hard to find him. And then everyone worked really hard and pretty much for free to cut all that footage together that we got in these interviews, 103 interviews we did. And it really worked out so well. We just won the Saturn Award for Best DVD Release last year. So people have been super happy with the product. And it's 4 hours long, the DVD, but it gives you more information about Nightmare than, gosh, anybody would ever want to know.
Yeah, it's by far, in my opinion, the best documentary of any, like, horror series. There's one for Friday the 13th. There's one for Halloween. They're coming out with one for Hellraiser. But that one is by far the best that I've ever seen.
Yeah, and I think it was sort of self-distributed, the DVD, right?
Yeah.
And that was, to me, that was a great move, because I think a lot of the studios really want to, I know the Friday the 13th one, they really cut that one up, it seemed like. And, yeah, it's just really, I was surprised how long it was. It was great. So.
No, I think when you have your own distribution plan, you can, you know, make it as long or short as you can, as you want to, because you're right about other distributors really want to fit it into that, like, hour and a half, 2 hour box. And we just had way too much to say. Plus we had so many, like, kind of crazy bonus features we wanted to put out. And, the idea to self-distribute, you know, it's a little tougher, I have to say. I mean, making deals for distribution in Europe and you know, all these foreign places that we want to sell it to, it's a lot tougher when you have a unique product like that. But we had we sold it to Biography, A&E channel, so it showed last year, and I hope it shows again this year. But they did cut it down quite a bit.
Hmm.
So you go from that to your documentary, I Am Nancy. Now, how did all that come about? What's the we haven't seen the movie, but give us an idea of.
Oh my gosh, I'm actually excited that you haven't seen it because that means I can send you a copy.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, let's see. At the same time, we were doing Never Sleep Again. I've always been a real fan of Nancy's. I've always thought that she was one of the best characters in horror history, and I always feel so grateful that I got to play her. And so I wanted to incorporate all of those feelings and all of those thoughts, but then I'm very aware of my fans and how much she means to them. And I have some really, really, really big fans. I mean, fans that write me letters and tell me everything that happened to them that day. And, I have some really special fans. So they visit me at conventions, and I always thought, it'd be great to incorporate their voice into a documentary, because that's the one thing that documentaries really shy away from is actually fan reviews and fan opinions and fan insights.
Mm-hmm.
And, these are the people that are paying the money to see the movie. I never understood why you never hear fan reviews unless you're, like, watching the TV and they put them on, after a movie they'll show some fans in the lobby. But in general, here's the people who actually made this movie so popular. We don't really know what they think. And so my first mission was to do a lot of fan interviews and pick out some of my favorites and really try to get to know those people really well. And so that's what I do. It starts out kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I focus on about 8 or 9 fans get really featured in the show. And then a lot of other fans just show up with 1 or 2 lines here and there, all saying really funny things. And kind of showcasing what it is to be a Freddy fan. And so I show people getting tattooed. I show people standing in line. I show people getting their picture taken with Robert. So you kind of really understand what the convention scene is all about. And then we meet fans who kind of take us to the next level, where we talk about, like, who is Nancy? Why is she so important? Why is she so iconic in her fight with Freddy? And so that kind of bumps the story up to this more symbolic level, a little bit more philosophical level. And then we have Wes come in, and he really talks about the philosophy of why he chose Nancy as her name, why he made her this strong, who he was modeling her after. And then we even go up one more level where we see the effect that the Nancy character had on Wes's own daughter, Jessica Craven, and how his creation of Nancy ended up being this really wonderful love letter to his own daughter. And then, the movie ends. I'm not going to say how it ends, but we go back to one of the fans who the movie's had a really profound effect on her life. And we really encourage everyone to take Nancy and really hold her dear to their heart, because she is a really great inspiration if you look at her that way. So it's a really touching movie. I mean, most of the guys that I've shown it to or who have seen it tell me that they get, like, choked up at the end. A lot of the guys involved in the editing process were like, wow, I didn't really think that this character would have such an effect on me. But, it was our goal to make people really reconsider their relationship with Freddie and consider whether Nancy has a bigger part in their heart, bigger place in their heart than they really think.
I mean, it sounds like you're going a lot deeper than some of the talking heads documentaries that have been in the past, where it's just a lot of stuff about the movies, and it sounds like there's... Yeah.
Well, after a while, I mean, there's only so much you can say about the movies, I guess.
That's true.
Very creative. There's not a whole lot of that going around.
Well, a lot of people in the 80s wrote lots of papers and books and stuff about the final girl and the kind of this new kind of character in American film, and Nancy's name was, batted around a lot as this final girl, But by doing that, I think they kind of pigeonholed her and made her into this thing that you can just say, oh, yeah, final girl Nancy. And I still felt that that was taking a lot away from her, because it was making her more one-dimensional. And she's a really complicated character. And the fact that she's just a girl and ends up living till the end of the movie is really not what she's about. I mean, it's kind of what she's about, but it's really more about her her spirit and why Wes created, what was so interesting to me is like, why did Wes write this character? And why did he make her a girl? And why did he, you know, who was he thinking about when he was thinking about Nancy? And Wes wasn't thinking, oh, I just want a girl to live to the end. I mean, that's so simplifies the whole thing. And, it's about like how she faces her fear, why she faces it and none of the other people do, why everybody else is running away from this, and avoiding the reality that Freddy is right there in their dreams. And, that need for her to stay awake to, you know, why aren't the other kids trying to stay awake? I mean, it's, she does so much. She doesn't just live to the end of the movie. She actually applies a really strong survival skill to stay alive. And that's part of the whole final girl mystique. But I wanted to really lay it out.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were filming a lot of this at horror conventions, you were saying, and there seems to be more and more of these popping up every day. What,
yeah.
Do you have any memorable experience, fan experiences, or just something that was like, it's like, what?
Well, there's bound to be some in this, in the documentary.
Well, I mean, every convention is just so has its own flavor and its own personality. I mean, each, like some of the conventions I go to are really wild, and everyone's dressing up, and there's lots of nudity, and people are spreading blood on the at night at their wild parties in the elevator, and wiping, you know, fake blood on the mirrors and stuff. I mean, there's some where people are obviously like letting it all hang out at these conventions and enjoying the partying scene that's going on. And then other conventions are just really super wholesome, and there's families coming and going to films and watching the film festival and getting their favorite autographs, and it has a different flavor every weekend that I go away. I like them both kind of. I like being a fly on the wall observing people be crazy, and then I really enjoy the families coming and grandmothers bringing their grandkids, and you know, there's both ends of the spectrum, and I kind of like them both. I never know what to expect when I'm getting there.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the craziest stuff actually happens after the convention is over. I don't know if you've witnessed any of that.
After we've locked the doors, yeah, people kind of, yeah, they're, you know, some cities like, you know, just have a harder partying kind of group. A lot of times people fly in from distant locations, and then some people drive 12 hours to get there. I mean, it's, you know, all types of people are coming to these places, and it's always different. I have to say, Florida is different than Philly, is different than Boston, it's really unique. That's why I wanted to show it in my movie, just really carnival atmosphere. And people are having a bunch of fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if you could, I mean, you've done this documentary now. You've talked to a lot of these people. If you could sum up, like, why it is that people find that character so appealing, like, what would you say?
Well, the answer I get is because she faced her fear. You know, she faces her fear, and she doesn't go out a back door, run away. She just really sits there and faces what's before her, and she's very energetic about it. I mean, she's really proactive. You know, she doesn't wait for him to come around the corner. She goes and finds him, and when she sees him, she jumps on him, and she lays booby traps for him. I mean, it's a kind of battle that, unfortunately, you just don't really see anymore in films.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, I mean, I'd really like to see it. I'm sure a lot of people that listen to this show would really, really like to see it. How does one go about getting it?
Well, it's pretty simple. If you have a radio show called deadpit.com, I'll send you a copy.
Sweet.
Well, that's awesome.
But if you don't, then there's two ways. You can order it from my website, which is iamnancy.net. And I have a blog. I have a homepage that has like news about where I'm going to be next. I have lots of pictures of me and my fans. It's just a fun website to just go visit just for the heck of it. And so that's a nice way to order it. You can order on a little shop there. I also have autographed pictures for sale there and posters and things. So that's a real like online store there. And then you can also order it on Amazon.com, and you plug in I Am Nancy documentary, and up will come the documentary, and you can buy it on Amazon. But you can't buy the poster Well, yeah, I don't think we have the poster yet up on Amazon. But the poster is kind of funny. And well, the front of the DVD is funny because I didn't know what to put on the front, and I decided, you know what, Nancy needs to be on the front, and she needs to have her pajamas on. So I got the pajamas that I have out of mothballs and put them on, and then my husband took my picture. And I've gained a little weight since back then, but it's okay. And then I decided to hold the coffee pot in my hand, just like every Freddy cover now, modern DVD cover of Nightmare on Elm Street has Freddy in his glove. He's just holding his glove down, you know. And I thought, you know, Nancy should have that same posture, but just with her coffee pot. So it's a really cute cover, and I'm super proud of it because, you know, I worked on it really hard, and that's also on the poster.
Cool. And a project I want to ask about, because I saw it on IMDb, and I don't, you can never tell with IMDb, but I mean, Butterfly Room, which is, is that still?
That is going to be coming out really soon. I just heard from the director. He just finished, and he's just going into his final post-production phase, but it's a really great story. I mean, I don't know what the movie looks like, but the reason I did it is because just very, very rarely do you get a part that is so powerful as this woman that I play. And she, you know, I play the daughter of Barbara Steele, who is a, you know, just an icon of horror movies. Mm-hmm. And when they said, oh, you're going to play Barbara Steele's daughter, I didn't even have to hesitate for a second to say yes. And it's a very strong role, and it's dark. It's really twisted and really, really dark. Barbara Steele plays a very evil woman. And
another thing I thought was interesting, though, is the leading ladies, I guess, from the other franchises, like Adrian King from
Friday
the 13th.
Oh, yeah, Adrian, and P.J. Souls is in it, and Erica from Halloween, mm-hmm. Erica, I can't remember her last name right now. But anyway, Jonathan Zerontanello is the Italian director, and he got financed from the Italian Film, Commission to make this film. And Barbara Steele is like a huge star in Italy, so they were more than happy to finance the film. And we had a small crew. We shot the movie in about 2.5 weeks. And it's extremely disturbing movie. But I just really love the character that I get to play. And I'm hoping that it comes out soon because I'm kind of like hitching my wagon to this movie, hoping it's good because I haven't acted in a long time. And I hope people see it and think of me for parts.
Oh, yeah. Are you wanting to go into acting like full time?
Yeah, I really would. But you need to show people something recent and, you know, everyone knows that I can play an 18-year-old, but, I mean, playing a woman, and it's tough unless you have some really modern film on yourself. It's tough to get parts. So this I'm hoping I can use for my reel and get people interested in me again.
Now, back to the Elm Street. Do you think the series, like you were saying, I guess the remake sequel is coming out. Do you think Wes Craven would ever maybe come back to the series and bring Robert Englund back, and would you be... Like, if you had a good enough script, would you be in it as well? I mean, would you up for it?
You know, I just don't know if Wes would want to do that. I mean, God, we all want him to do it again because he has something special when it comes to Nancy and Freddie and himself. And he really understands something about those characters that nobody else does. And I just don't know. I just think that maybe he's done, you know. I think he's done.
Hmm. I that's really all.
With Freddie and Nancy, I think that doesn't hold much for him, unfortunately, because of the way that deals are structured and licenses are made and characters are owned, and it's just, I think, something that maybe doesn't appeal to him.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in terms of projects or...
Well, no, I mean, my husband and I worked on Cabin in the Woods. I hope everybody goes and sees it. It's coming out, I'm hoping, this year.
Yeah,
and we made all the monsters for that. And we just are really, really proud of our work in there. And I know you have such a following of horror fans that I'm hoping and hoping and hoping that the movie is worth everyone's weight. And then, I'm just trying to sell my DVD, you know. Mm. Everything kind of hinges on that right now, so I'm trying to get a TV deal for that. So if you see it on your cable channel in the near future around Halloween, you know, do video on demand, or I'm not sure who's going to buy it, but I'm hoping that by Halloween it's definitely on TV, and I'd love everybody to check it out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But, yeah, we'd like to thank
but
you.
But, in the meantime, buy a copy, and then I can pay my bills.
Right.
I feel unhappy. I feel so sad. I've lost the best friend that I ever had. She was my woman. I love her so. But it's too late now. I've let her go.
Hi, this is Gunnar Hansen from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You're listening to DeadPit.com.
Hi, everybody. Creepy Kentuckian back with you. Hope you guys enjoyed the interview with Heather. It's always great to finally, you know, we had this show. We had like a bucket list of people that we wanted to interview. And she was on it since pretty much day one. We wanted to get an interview with her. Even more than Robert Englund. Like, I can't really even explain it. I just thought that her character was more fascinating to me and just really, really, related to her, and really great performance in that movie, and really, really nice person. I was, pleasantly surprised. And, also we did receive that copy of I Am Nancy, on DVD. Another pleasant surprise that she actually sent it, because a couple of times people say, oh, I'll send you guys a copy of that shit. We never get it. But we did get it, and we will review it at some point down the line. It's another thing that I'm going to have to figure out how we're going to do these reviews, because around this time of year, August, September, October, is they're going to send you all kinds of shit to review. So I'm probably going to do those reviews either on YouTube or on Facebook. And post them up for you guys, because we're going to get really, really behind if I don't do these reviews. So I will do some of those solo, but I think we can review I Am Nancy next time we get together and do a Dead Pit show. So yeah, Nancy, Heather Langenkamp was on that bucket list from way back in 2006. And the list is getting shorter and shorter. I mean, there's actually only like two major names left that we would like to interview. And one is pretty much impossible, and that's Toby Hooper, who I was told actually has to get paid quite a bit of money to even do an interview for his own movie on DVD. And I've been told that by a couple of people. So the odds of us actually getting him to do an interview with us for nothing are very slim. The other one is Wes Craven, who I think that we could get an interview with. I don't know how good it would be, because Wes Craven seems to be one of those guys. I like Wes Craven, don't get me wrong. He's, aside from John Carpenter, he's probably my favorite filmmaker of that era as far as the movies that he came out with. You're talking about the original Hills Have Eyes, which is up there, definitely top five favorite movies of all time. Last House on the Left is another one. Of course, Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream, and even some of the lesser known movies. People Under the Stairs, Shocker, you know, a lot of people dig Shocker. I kind of dig it too. Deadly Friend, which we've mentioned on here before. Just a really, you know, of that era, probably my number two favorite filmmaker, and I'd love to get him on the show, but who knows? Who knows when and if that'll happen? But yeah, that primarily those two, And a lot of people say Dario Argento. Get Dario on the show and talk about Baklava. Give me some Baklava. The guy can't speak English. Like, how the fuck are we going to interview him? We're going to have like an interpreter in there with him. So I don't see that happening. Yeah, a couple of smaller guests. But man, we've interviewed so many fucking people though. It's, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, some other horror podcast had Heather Langenkamp on. You know, do they really matter? That's my question to you guys. I would put our interview with Heather up against any of those. You know, not to be bragging, but I mean, I just think that we ask the questions that people want the answers to. We don't bullshit. You know, I always hated that when I was listening to like wrestling radio shows, which is mainly the only podcast I ever listened to is this wrestling podcast. And it's always been that way too, where they would just bullshit with them and try to talk to them about sports and stuff like that. Nobody gives a fuck about that shit. So, yeah, but that was the Heather Langenkamp interview, and it really is difficult to talk to yourself doing these radio shows. This is something that I could not do full time. There's no way. It's really hard. It's a lot more fun to have one or two other people in here talking horror with you. You can just really bounce back and forth off each other. And I'm not funny at all. Like a stand-up comedian. People say you could be a stand-up comedian. No, I really fucking couldn't. Because I have to have that other person to bounce back and forth off of. You know, doing this stuff by yourself is very difficult. And it's even more difficult to make it funny. I'm not funny by myself at all. And anybody that's met me usually... but if I have somebody, Uncle Bill, primarily, to play off of, I can do okay, I think. But it's hard to do this show by yourself. For a while there, when Uncle Bill was going to janitorial school, I was doing these shows by myself. And sometimes I would have somebody from Skype on, and that's primarily how a lot of these radio shows exist. They have friends on the internet that they talk back and forth with Skype on. For some people, that can work. You know, that can work well with you guys, some of you radio shows and stuff. But with me, I always, you know, it's always the deal where you're interrupting somebody. And, you know, it's not the same to me. But I hope you guys have enjoyed this show. I know that it's been a short edition of Dead Pit again. And people will probably complain. That's the nature of the internet. But please realize that this is something that, you know, I thought about maybe taking the calls this week and that would extend the length of the show. But again, I didn't have a chance to really promote the fact that we were doing call-ins. So that would have probably been a weak segment. Just one of those things. I didn't know what was going on until, you know, about this time yesterday evening. And the severity of the situation, stuff like that. But, yeah, I hope you guys realize that we at least try to do something for you guys and not leave you out in the cold if, you know, we can help it. But this is one of those situations that, fuck, you know, this isn't the show. This is something, you know, more personal. And, you know, definitely I don't want to, you know, it's the show is one thing. This is his family and stuff like that. It's, and I've had problems too that, I've kept secret and I'm not going to give any details out because this is, you know, you guys don't need to know this shit. But everything's going fine with them. We will see where it goes and I'll see what he wants me to put up. I'm not going to give out too much info about what's going on. But hopefully everything will be fine. I think it will be, with that. And we will, be back sooner than later as a trio of terror, trilogy of terror, a triangle of evil. That is it. And next week, like I said, is going to be another fan pit. I will try to let you guys know if we could do a topic or something. I'm willing to bet that I will be the only one here next week. Pretty sure of that as well. But I want to keep this show moving along, and I want to post up some reviews over the next week or so on YouTube. Some stuff that I've watched, and just so I can get some of these reviews out of the way. And because, like I said, the next couple of months are going to be huge as far as releases go and screeners and stuff like that. So we got to get some of this stuff out of the way to prepare ourselves for the future that is, you know, the month of October, September and October. Just insane. So anyway, that's it for this week. I will be back next week with you guys, Creepy Kentucky in here, and I'll keep you posted on all things Uncle Bill and Jessica related. And yeah, that is it. And be sure to check out our MySpace. What the fuck is MySpace page? Fuck, 2000. Does anybody go on MySpace? We do still have a MySpace page, I think. But go to our Facebook Universe page, Dead Pit Universe on Facebook, and check that out. And that will keep you updated there as well. Dead Pit message boards and all those Dead Pit related pages, baby. Also, I do want to mention that for fans that need to quench their thirst a little bit more for Dead Pit, this week we're putting up the Rob Zombie Halloween drunken commentary that we did a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, you guys got to hear it to believe it. It will be up this weekend, and I will let you guys know where you can get it. It'll be like $3, which is what all of our commentaries are. So, yeah, there you go, folks. Creepy Kentuckian signing off. I'll be back next week. We'll take some phone calls, and I'll try to plan things out a little bit better next week so I'll know what's going on. And we will move on. Yeah. So we'll see you guys next week.
That I took your love for granted. about sweet love, Lord. Woman, won't you come back home?
Back home.